Change is gonna come.
See that you actually are a leader.
I was with Nike for a very long time and built my career in retail.
You know, I think this podcast just got its first exclusive.
Being an entrepreneur is hard. The highs are really high and then the lows are really low.
That I'm actually really interested in hearing more about.
Building more and more books of business.
Can you talk to us a little bit about what it's like transitioning verticals?
Being open to opportunity.
How do I learn something different in a different industry?
And I feel like, okay, like, if not now, then when?
Thanks so much for joining us for today's Motivated Podcast. We typically feature some thought leaders and industry experts and discuss what they're working on, some of the strategies that they've deployed during this time, and most importantly, how they've shifted their mindset and how they're keeping themselves and the people around them motivated. I am here with my wonderful co-host, Pablo Henderson. He's the VP of Marketing from Equinox Hotels.
Hi, Dahlia. And we're thrilled to have Scott Miller on the show today, who's the Executive Vice President at Franklin Covey and the host of On Leadership with Scott Miller. So welcome, Scott.
Thank you for the invite and the platform today.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So I think what we've really learned is that in order to understand where you are today, we'd love to hear a little bit of your background. How did you even get started? And fill us in on, like, I don't know, some moments that have motivated your career.
Sure. So I'm 52. I live now in Salt Lake City with my wife, Stephanie, and our three sons, Thatcher, who is 10, Smith, who is 8, and Wentworth, who is 6. Don't do that. Don't have three boys in 5 years. That was probably not well thought out. But before that, you know, I'm from Florida. I live in Utah now. I moved here 25 years ago. I'm actually from Orlando, Florida. Went to school there. Worked for the Disney company for 4 years, the Disney development company. They build everything and sell it back to the Walt Disney Company. Had a great run. After just shy of 4 years, they invited me to leave, which is another way of saying get out. So they canned me. And I was young and arrogant and not exactly great for the culture, which is a whole different podcast. But Disney invited me to leave when I was 23. And the Franklin Covey Company invited me to join them and move to Utah, which is fascinating because I was kind of let go from Disney from being a poor leader. And here comes the world's most famous leadership company calling, which means they saw something in me that I probably didn't see in myself. So here is a single Catholic boy from Orlando moving to Provo, Utah. Do the math. Maybe great for like an internship in the summer, but not long term. So here I land in Utah. And I've had an amazing run, an amazing ride. I've been blessed to have been the recipient of 9 separate careers inside one organization for 25 years. Lived around the world, Chicago for 6 years, London, here in Utah 3 or 4 times. Started as a frontline salesperson, selling leadership solutions to universities, school districts, colleges. Became a sales leader, a sales general manager, sales vice president. I was the chief marketing officer for the global Franklin Covey brand for 8 years. And then stepped away from that about 2 years ago to become an author, a writer, a podcaster. I'm now privileged to host the world's largest distributed and subscribed to leadership podcast in the world called On Leadership. 150 or so episodes. And it's all culminating with me on your podcast today. So it's been a great ride. Usually about 3 steps forward, 2 steps back, sometimes 4 steps back, right? But I'm still in the saddle, learning every day and delighted to be here today to talk about some of my messes and some of my successes.
Your personality is so true to form. He actually made a point of saying he interrupts people, but not by choice, just because it's part of his personality.
Pablo said that?
No, you said that.
I know. I'm working on it, I swear.
No, I like that part of your personality, I have to tell you. So Pablo and I were talking about your book a little bit yesterday, but I just think it's really interesting because everything that you brought up, you started with the negatives and then you found ways to turn it into positives. And it was really interesting and inspiring to read, especially from a leadership standpoint. Like how do you, and we talked about this on a previous podcast with Samantha Saperstein, where we discussed the fail fast method, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that in a way you've proven that out with leadership, like fail on your face and iterate and improve, right? So I feel like
daily.
Daily.
Right. I mean, you have to have a level of resilience to be a leader. I had an article that the Utah Business Magazine, so it's kind of like a legit magazine here, digital print. They asked me if I would write a 2,000-word article for the August edition. We scoped it out. I submitted it, and they rejected it. And I'm like, wait, but you asked me to write it. You've seen my writing. And I blogged about it today saying, you know what? You got to pick yourself up and move on, right? Somebody else will take it and love it, right?
That's true.
I hope.
That is true.
Yeah, and we'll get to those messes quite shortly.
I'm sure you will.
For those that are not familiar with the company, Franklin Covey, can you just give like the quick, yes,
sure.
You mentioned that it's leadership, but you know, I think most people are probably unfamiliar with the full spectrum of services.
Yeah, you're probably right. So Franklin Covey is the result of a merger about 25 years ago from the Franklin Quest Company. You may know the Franklin Planner. We at one point had 170 retail stores selling Franklin Planners, Palm Pilots, software, the largest probably time management firm in the world. And it's sort of arch rival was owned by Dr. Stephen R. Covey, who invented the content around the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. That book is now in its 30th year, has sold, can you believe it, 40 million copies. And together they came together and made this juggernaut called the Franklin Covey Company. We're sort of out of the planner business. We're now solely a professional services performance improvement company, helping organizations build leadership capacity, cultures, executing on strategy, managing your time. We're a prolific author and publishing company. We're mainly a training and consulting firm with offices in every country in the world where the State Department says it's legal to be. So thanks for that moment to let me kind of clarify who we are.
So I'm fascinated with your trajectory. You started off young, hungry, a little arrogant at Disney. and then all of a sudden you decide to pick up, move to Utah, try something new. Yeah. Tell us about that experience. I mean, people aren't always so quick to be excited about change.
Yeah, it was probably frightening for me. Truth be told, didn't have a lot of options. And I had been to Utah, believe it or not, on business for Disney. Long story. But I had been to Utah, and honestly, it was the opposite of Orlando. No billboards, no neon, no humidity, 4 seasons. Wasn't a lot of diversity, which was probably, you know, not the best thing in terms of, you know, cultural, broadening my horizons. But I knew the brand was excellent. Wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do with my career. Needed to earn a living. So I kind of, on a bit of a wing and a prayer, moved across the country. That was a big deal for me. And there was some setbacks. I mean, you know, Utah 25 years ago was probably 80% members of one faith. It was a very dominant culture, right? I was a bull in a china shop. And, you know, people used to always say, oh, Scott, you're so funny, which meant, Scott, we don't talk that way here, right? It was a hard culture to assimilate in. I'm more like a, you know, Northeasterner, even though I'm from the Southeast. You know, I got a bit of a hard-charging personality and say what's on my mind too frequently. So it was a big education for me to assimilate into the culture, not just the state, but the company. But, you know, I think people also learned from me that Utah wasn't the world, right? They lived in a bit of a bubble and a microcosm, and that was lovely, but not real. And so I think I've added a lot of cultural, I won't say diversity, but cultural perspective to the organization. But you're right, Dahlia, it was a big risk for me. Of course, what did I have to lose, right? I mean, you know, $1,000 in the bank and some luggage, right? So it was a great ride. People here trusted me, invested in me, coached me, told me what not to say, what not to do. And I've been the beneficiary my whole life of people who believed in me more than I believed in myself, put their arm around me and kind of shepherd me through and sometimes saved me from myself.
You mentioned this irony of moving to a company that focused on leadership when you had just kind of, someone had not seen leadership potential in you potentially, right?
Yeah.
And so this idea of maybe not seeing within ourselves the things that other people can see, I think is fascinating from a leadership perspective, because many of the opportunities that have thrust me, propelled me into the next like sphere of leadership have not been through my own choosing. I was identified by someone else who said, I think you can do this. And, and I had some self-doubt that I overcame. You host on leadership.
Yeah.
Is that a reoccurring theme, or do you think that leaders in general, they know that they're going to be in that position and they're destined to some extent for that?
It's a complex question. Let me unwrap it a couple of ways. One is, I don't think everyone should be a leader of people. And I'm a bit of a pariah in the industry. Not everyone should be an anesthesiologist. Not everyone should be a commercial airline pilot or a dental hygienist. I don't think that everyone should be a leader of people. In fact, Pablo, I'll tell you, I'm not sure I should have been a leader of people. Maybe I should have been a defense attorney, right? Or a realtor. I don't know. I'm pretty good in a sales environment. I like to speak, clearly. But not everyone should be a leader of people, because what happens in organizations is often we promote the top producing independent contributor, right? The top salesperson or the most creative digital designer, and we make them leaders of people when those skills are not transferable. What makes you the best salesperson is usually inversely correlated to the leadership skills you need. So I would say to your listeners and viewers, not everyone should be a leader of people, and that's just fine. Now, if you are the owner or the entrepreneur, or you're the founder, you may also decide that your best contribution is chief revenue officer or chief visionary or chief partnerships or chief investment, communicator. Because you are the owner does not mean you need to be the leader of people. Maybe you're chief strategist. Don't be fearful of being transparent, of being vulnerable. These are leadership competencies. These aren't just pages on a book. Vulnerability and transparency are leadership competencies. You may have second mortgaged your home for your business. That doesn't mean you need to be also the chief human resource officer. It may not be your natural talent. You mentioned the podcast, Pablo. I interviewed a gentleman named David Epstein. He wrote the book Range. I think it's an extraordinary book. And he talked about how most people's careers follow either a generalist or a specialist route, right? Specialists like, a thoracic surgeon or chemical engineer, right? Or patent attorney. And for those of us who are not specialists, me, a generalist, we tend to be kind of rather jealous of those people out of college in their 20s and 30s because they're making coin, they're paying down their debt, they're building a practice. And here we are doing a lot of things, right? We're writing, we're speaking, we're leading, we're selling, we're project managing. And we have this sort of insecurity in our 20s and our 30s. And then our 40s start to kick in. We start to realize, wow, all those things that I've learned are building this massive knowledge base that allows me to be an entrepreneur, that allows me to take some risks, that allows me to draw upon all these skills. I'm going to go on QVC. I'm going to go probably on PBS as a fundraiser. I'm on television. I'm on podcast. I'm doing interviews. I'm on your podcast today, right? I'm writing articles. I never could have done that stuff. How to become a patent attorney or a chemical engineer. There aren't a lot of chemical engineers that serve as thought leaders. My brother has an MBA from MIT. And a master's in chemical engineering, and was the CEO of two Amazon companies, right? And he can Six Sigma me into the ground. But Mike has other areas of which I excel in, right? And that's the ability to probably speak extemporaneously, feel comfortable in front of 5,000 people, master a stage. And so we all have strengths. I bring it back, Dahlia, to this idea of not everyone should be a leader. If you are going to be a leader, there are some natural principles that govern all human interaction. And I wrote this book, Management Mess to Leadership Success, because quite frankly, I failed at most of them and had to learn how to turn my messes into successes. The last thought is, because as a leader, if you are vulnerable, if you are transparent, then you will own your mess. Because every leader has a mess and everybody knows what your mess is. Your receptionist, your investors, your salespeople, they all know your messes. So just set the standard, own your mess. Because as a leader, when you do own your mess, you make it safe for others to own theirs. Not to wallow, not to make excuses, but to move from mess to success.
So in the beginning of your book, you actually talk about one of your very early messes. You hosted a leadership conference. and you made some bold statements where you gave people the option to opt out of working there. And some left and some didn't have the nicest things to say. Tell us about that experience. Yeah. And what was the ultimate learning that you took away from it?
I think everyone has found themselves in this role early on in their career, right? You get promoted to be the leader and you think my job is to turn everybody else into my clone, my work ethic, my creativity, my style, my process, my sequence. Of course, that's preposterous. But honestly, even working for a leadership company, no one told me that. No one told me the skills that made me the best salesperson are not the skills that make me the best sales leader. Right? A leader's mindset needs to be, your job is to get work done with and through other people. That's simple but profound. As a leader, your job is to get work done with and through other people. Your job is not to be the smartest person in the room. Your job is not to be the genius, but rather the genius maker of others. That comes from Liz Wiseman in her book, Multipliers. I think Multipliers is the best leadership book written in the last decade. But to your point, Dahlia, I walk into this meeting, two-day leadership conference. I'd planned it. I put my political street cred on the line, and I was training the 17 people who reported to me on a new leadership product. Day one, they're all late. 15 minutes late, 20 minutes late, 30 minutes late, 35 or so minutes later, we finally start. And I was like incensed, right? As most new leaders do, I took everything personally. It's all about me and you're affront to my authority. How dare you disrespect whatever, right? I was young. I was 27. I was a jackass, quite frankly. Well-intended, but my techniques were so immature. So I stew on it all day long. And like a lot of leaders, I start to confuse my emotions, my opinions, and my feelings with facts. They didn't come late because they were trying to offend me. They came late because apparently I hadn't set the standards for what we were all trying to build as a culture. I was so insecure, so self-absorbed. That night I go home. Like a lot of leaders, I metastasize it in my head. I build a false reality of people's intentions. And the next morning, instead of going and buying fruit and pastries, I buy about 17 copies of the Salt Lake Tribune. I walk in ready to catch them being late on day two, right? A horrible paradigm for a leader. Catch them being late. Sure enough, they fulfill my prophecy. They're all late. And I open the meeting with grand flair. And I throw the newspaper down in front of them, the classified sections. And I say, if you want a job from 9 to 5, Dillard's is hiring. My finest leadership moment. Strength, conviction, charisma, clarity, verbal insult. I mean, right? You can read the book to find out the point. The point is, that's not leadership. That's called dictatorship. Right? That's not a culture anyone wants to work in. It took me 20 years to figure out that as a leader, you create culture in every interaction, every text, every email, every newspaper on the paper, every conference call, every Zoom call, every interaction you build or destroy culture. And people don't quit their jobs. They quit bad bosses and corrupt cultures. And to one more thought, we hear this adage, Dahlia, that people are an organization's most valuable asset. It's not true. It's HR bunk. People are not a company's most valuable asset. It is the relationships between those people that becomes your ultimate competitive advantage. Because Dahlia can have an Oxford, degree and be a Rhodes Scholar. And Pablo can have a black belt in lean manufacturing. But if, or vice versa, because he's a Brit originally. You get the point, but if they can't get along, complement each other's skill sets, forgive each other, pre-forgive each other, there's no culture. So as no matter how big or what you're struggling with in your organization, remember that your job is to build culture, set the standard in your behaviors, because what you do and say gets modeled to others, and that's what gets done.
So wait, how could you have motivated them to show up on time? What would you have done differently?
Oh, a lot. I would have sat down on day two and said, hey, everybody, I'm struggling with something. I thought that I had set a clear 8:30 start time. Clearly, I wasn't clear on that because no one honored that except for Nancy and I. And so I clearly need to work on setting better parameters. Did anybody hear me say 8:30? Would anybody here give me some feedback on why that appeared out to be important? Was it too early? Well, what's going on? Should we have set the start time together so everybody felt like they owned it? It wasn't me owning it, forcing it on them. Now, the fact of the matter is, I didn't start at 5:30, right? So 8:30 was not an unreasonable time. But for whatever, I had not involved them in the process. Dr. Covey used to always say, no involvement, no commitment. No involvement, no commitment. So I could have been less unilateral. I should have sat people down before the meeting and said, hey, what kind of culture do we want to create? What kind of environment do we all want to work in? What's going to make us renew ourselves, remotivate ourselves, be joyful to come to work in hard times and in good times? How are we going to track our success? How are we going to make sure we know if we're winning or if we're losing? How are we going to provide feedback to each other when someone has their feelings hurt or an expectation violated? I would have sat down, had I now know what I know now, and had everybody collaborate and set the standards together. Because peers tend to hold peers more accountable than leaders do in culture.
I couldn't agree more. It's funny because you were talking about the specialist versus generalist. I'm very much a generalist. I'm a creative thinker. I'm a rule breaker. I'm very much a free-form thinker in connecting the dots.
And so Dahlia's told me. She's been blogging about it for weeks. I know all about it, Pablo.
Mind, Scott. I'm literally about to put together an Instagram post about all of this.
and yet, you've made a couple jokes about Six Sigma, right? As in there's like a specific personality trait or person that follows Six Sigma. I found Six Sigma to be one of the best things that I've done in my career.
Yeah.
Because for the person like me to be able to be grounded in actual process while taking, becoming green belt was not something that I loved. You know, it's not the most passionate thing. I've fallen back on that type of skill set to offset my creative madness. This is a question more so about balance. Do you think leaders need to lean into the things that they're also not naturally gifted towards? Of like strengthening who you are?
I think to some extent, right? I think there's a reason why Now Discover Your Strengths or Strengths Finder is the number one best-selling book for like 10 years, right? Because the methodology from Marcus Buckingham and Don Clifton from Gallup was that life is short, run with your strengths. Now, we also know that it's hard to be a business owner, an entrepreneur, without having supply chain knowledge and vendors and finance and probably some project management experience, understanding margin and cost of goods and inventory turns, and also knowing how to create culture, how to give feedback, how to recruit and retain talent. I mean, all those skills are required when you're an entrepreneur, when you're a small business owner, when you're starting up. I get that. I also think there's a fine tension, and this is what you're leading to, Pablo, right, is not spending so much of your time trying to build the skills that aren't naturally your skills. I am never going to become a chemical engineer. Could I? Probably in 10 years, but it's not worth the precious hours that I have left on the earth, right? That's not my natural talent. I was the chief marketing officer, but I had to understand how to calculate EBITDA. I had to be very, very adept at reading a P&L and being able to not just read it, but to read it and let it sing to me and pick it apart and know which levers to pull. That's not a natural talent for a chief marketing officer who's thinking about fonts and colors and feelings and interviews and focus groups, right? And direct mail or Google Analytics, maybe more so that. I think great leaders are those that move outside their comfort zone and build a wealth of knowledge. They have this insatiable curiosity, but yet they don't go down rabbit holes, that they're confident enough and they're vulnerable enough to hire people around them that complement those skills. I know nothing about Marketo. I know nothing about Google search algorithms, but I'm doing my best now later in life to make sure I find the most talented person around me where I can say in meetings, now, how is Disney Plus different from Netflix? What's the value prop there? And ask in a meeting where some of my millennials will groan, right? And like dinosaur, but I built a culture where it's safe to ask that because I'm also learning from people around me. I don't mean to dog the genius that is process engineering and Six Sigma and Lean. Obviously, we use it in our company. But I'm not going to put my precious time into building acumen around it where my talent is naturally in other areas, right? I have to have a functioning knowledge, but just that, a functioning knowledge.
Yeah.
So I don't try to be all things to all people.
Yeah. And I think that I'm in an interesting place right now where I teach continuing education and a majority of people that have taken my classes and are still taking my classes are toying with the idea of relocating, switching jobs. What should they be thinking about? And I'm getting these messages daily where you just mentioned, is it worth it for me to spend the next 10 years learning this skill set? What would you recommend for somebody that might be in a transition state and trying to figure out what their next step is going to be?
Variety of things. I just actually wrote an article about this for another magazine. I think a couple of things. Broad advice, adapt what's right for you. Don't get into a rebound relationship because the last thing you want to do is have 12 years in one company or 22 years and then you're desperate for a job. I get it, right? You got to feed the kids. And then you get into a company and the culture eats you up because it's the wrong fit. And now you've been there for 9 months and now you're sort of a little bit of a damaged goods to someone, right? Be more be as deliberate as you can be without jumping into a rebound relationship. I think also, as you're thinking about your pivot, be really thoughtful around, what do you want to do? What do you want your legacy to be? What brings you joy, right? I mean, it's kind of annoying. You hear these celebrity artists that just say, well, once you find what you love, you'll never work a day in your life. Well, BS, right? Because that's like one half of 1% of 1% of the population. Thank you, Keith Urban and Nicole Kidman. Love you. Go back on stage. Now, for the other 7.29 billion people, sorry for that tirade. You get the point. Take some time. What are your favorite brands? What are you passionate about? Because that passion is going to come out naturally in your resume, in your interview. Get off these aggregator sites and Googling six-figure paying jobs in your zip code. That is not how to find a job. Stop Googling six-figure sales jobs in your zip code. You will last for 12 months. Instead, take some post-it notes and write out what you love. I love kombucha. I love Polo. I love Ralph Lauren. I love Orange Theory. I love Six Sigma. I love beer, whatever it is, right? And start thinking about them and then say, you know what, my dream job is working in a hops beer manufacturing where IPO beers that get distributed and I love sales. And then start to think about what are those companies, because your passion will come through naturally. Something else, dig your well before you're thirsty. It's a famous title of a book by Harvey McKay. I don't know what the statistic is, but it is off the charts. The percentage of people who get hired in companies because they knew someone who referred them in. You're going to be one of those 25,000 resumes that goes through a career screening algorithm to pick up keywords, and you have no advantage. Build your well. Get on LinkedIn. Connect to people. Friend up. Ask me about that later. Friending up is the best strategy I ever had in my life, right? Post some Google articles. Post some Facebook stuff. Get on Twitter. Build your social media, right? Build reciprocal networks. Take 3 days and say, instead of trying to solve my needs, I'm going to spend 3 days solving as many needs for as many people as possible, selflessly, and not ask for anything in return. Pick up the phone and call 5 friends who are down and out, worse than you are, and offer a kind word. How can I help you? Can we go for a walk? I got $3. I'll treat you to Starbucks on the run. Just listen to them. Genuinely, those relationships will pay off for you in the long term. Dig your well before you're thirsty. Now, for people who've been disrupted, I think you got to show some unprecedented courage. Move outside your comfort zone and don't believe the narrative that's been told about you. I'm pretty good at inflating my ego. And I say that because it helps to inoculate me from the hundreds of thousands of detractors that I have, right? People don't like my hair or my glasses, or I talk too fast, or I think I'm not credible, or I'm a hack, or whatever, whatever, whatever. Get on Glassdoor. There's thousands of them. That's not my posse. You're my posse, right? So I go where the love is. I do not let all that negativity enter my head. People yesterday took me down on one of my Facebook posts, right? My wife would have, you know, ended it over reading the first negative one. I'm like Reagan times 10. Bing! Teflon, right? Go to my posse, Teflon Scott. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't take feedback. I take lots of feedback from about 5 people. I've carefully curated people in my life, personally and professionally, that get me, that have a balance between let Scott be Scott and Scott, let's figure out what your brand's going to be like, right? What are you really going to contribute?
Advisory board? Would you say this is the equivalent to an advisory board?
Completely. Absolutely. That's exactly what it is, Pablo, right? It's not 15 people. They don't have to assemble every month for a podcast or a Zoom room, right? They have an open door to me to say, Scott, I loved your Facebook post yesterday. Scott, I thought the video of you and the protesters was not wise, or whatever the word is, right? Or that, you know, I actually posted something on Facebook. In Salt Lake City, we had a fair amount of looting going on. And I posted a video of the Black Hawk helicopter around my neighborhood for like 5 days. And I shared some frustration. And there were a fair number of employees in the company who complained to HR that I was being insensitive. The fact of the matter is my 10-year-old was having some panic attacks from 7 days of this Black Hawk helicopter around our house, because we lived downtown. But my Facebook post was not received well. I took it down because some people felt like I wasn't understanding the Black Lives Matter movement, right? And so I did some interviews, I learned some more, better appreciated. But that was one of those people who called me. If someone else had said, take it down, I probably would have like dug in. But this person who I trust that has my best success in mind called me and said, take it down right now, take a breath, call me back in 5 minutes. And I just took it down, took a breath, I called him back. He let me rage. He let me talk. I let him talk, and I came to a different place.
I think it's so interesting that they chose to go to HR instead of coming to you directly.
Oh, it's so true. First of all, people are cowards. That's not a character flaw. That's a personality trait. People are naturally cowardly. But let me tell you, it actually said more about me than it did about them. And let me tell you why. Because clearly, Delia, I had not built a brand where they felt comfortable coming to me. As much as I wanted to be frustrated with them, the fact of the matter is, had I built a brand where they didn't feel I was going to use my positional power against them, I was going to rip their head off, I was going to talk them out of it. If I had built a brand with that person that they felt comfortable influencing me, they might have come to me. So much as I'd like to blame them, I blame me. Not entirely. I can't take the world's problems on my back. But I was introspective to say, what could I have done differently previously that would have provided a safe path for them to come talk to me? That's good advice to every leader. If your people are lying to you, it's not because they're liars. It's because you built a culture where you've made it not safe for them to tell you the truth. It's a good lesson in that for leaders.
I think it's really interesting also that that you've been able, and just stemming from your book and then also these case scenarios, you've been able to take these as moments and lessons as opposed to saying, woe is me, right? So you're able to just like you mentioned, think introspectively and evaluate how could I change or how could I solve this problem and create a solution and maybe create a better scenario for the future.
Dahlia, that came to me, honestly, in my late 40s. I'm 52 now, and I worked for 25 years for the world's most prominent leadership development company. And I think it took me, honestly, 23 years to stop being so precious with my reputation, meaning like my insecurities, right? I kind of, Brené Brown gave me some more permission, right, to own my vulnerabilities. You may not know that I have a really pronounced stutter. I'm a stutterer. There are about 26 words I cannot say in public. I've been through decades of speech pathology and speech therapy and braces twice and headgear and retainers. And I used to be really insecure about it. Now I wear it as a badge of honor, right? It's very common for me to say, that's very common.
I would never have guessed that. You've done a great job.
I've worked hard at it. But I think when you own your mess, you make it safe for others to own theirs. And so as I share some of these insights, these came the hard way. I mean, read the book, don't read the book. It's full of 30 messes that you will encounter. And if you read my story, you will step around the pothole versus like in the pothole like I did. I'm less now worried about protecting who I seem to be and allowing people to see the real me and what my struggles, my jealousies, my pettinesses, my insecurities, because most leaders aren't bad people. They're just people. And they're people that are trying to become better leaders. You know, the Harvard Business Review published a study a year ago that said the average age that someone receives their first promotion into their first management position, age 30. We get the age they receive their first formal leadership development training, age 42. Mm-hmm. So there's 12 years of well-intended Scott Millers wrecking havoc across organizations, not because they're bad people, because they're people, right? And they're learning how to talk, how to listen, how to balance, how to get work done with and through other people. I want to revisit that because I think that's profound.
So what about these Scott Millers of the world who are trying to navigate a world that has no rule book right now? And part of what we've done by recording these podcast during this very specific time is we're capturing sentiment in nearly an anthropological way around what's happening during COVID. And I think what's useful is the insights that you can provide to leaders during this specific time, because these are truly uncharted waters.
True.
What are the additional layers that you think need to be taken into consideration from a leadership perspective?
You know what, Pablo? There is a rule book. The same principles still govern human relationships, right? Having an abundance mentality versus having a scarcity mentality. That rule still applies. The fact that relationships are an organization's most valuable asset, or as your individual, relationships is everything, still applies. That your reputation is merely the collection of all of your decisions in life, that principle still applies. So I think you're right. And obviously, it's just absolute chaos. And it's going to continue for months and perhaps a year to come, right?
But you mentioned these things that I agree with 100%. But it's harder for your reputation or for relationships to come through when sometimes it's the small little things that strengthen your brand, right? You know, the time that someone wasn't feeling well and you were able to say, hey, just head home for the rest of the day. I got you. I'll cover it, or whatever it is. You can't do that from a Zoom call, or, you know, when you're not interacting.
You have to.
So
you have to.
You have to.
You have to. Because that's the new reality, right? These same skills, your point is well taken. So we have to figure out how to adapt. Here's something I would suggest. I'm asked so frequently, well, Scott, I'm so concerned my people aren't working hard and their productivity's down. And I say back to them, what are you talking about? That thought has never crossed my mind. I mean, I lead a team of only 10 people, but it's never crossed my mind that their productivity is low. Because I set a standard back in the olden days of what's expected, quality outcomes, contribution. Now, I'll bet they're crippled. I'll bet they're like me. They're panicked. I'll bet they're fraught with fear. I'll bet they're burnt out. I'll bet they're trying to have some life balance and they're scared to take a vacation day. So my job as a leader is to change my mindset and rather check on them, check in with them. It's a small, subtle change, because people know when you're checking in versus you're checking on. So call up your team member on Zoom and say, how are you doing today? I'm doing fine, Scott. How are you? Quite frankly, I'm stressed out, right? My three kids are running around. They're killing me on the iPads and Minecraft, all the things they want to do. And they phoned in the last 4 months of private school. My wife and I are on each other's case. I can't have one more night of, you know, chicken and potatoes. It's driving me crazy. And I need a vacation bad. And I work from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. And can you relate as a leader? I'd give her a little permission to say, it's okay, right? We're all scared. We're all petrified. We're all trying to reinvent ourselves. We're all working too hard. I want you to go out for a 90-minute walk today. Pour yourself an iced tea. Put something in it if you want to strengthen it. Go out for an iced tea and just think about all the good things happening in your life. I've got your back, working hard. I trust you. I don't want you to burn out. Now, granted, there are some businesses that are in free fall, right? Not everyone can afford to take an hour and a half off and pay someone $20, but I get it. But there are some small things you can do to validate what is real. Fear, paranoia. If you can release someone from their paranoia that their job isn't going away, tell them that. If you can release them from their paranoia by telling them your job might go away, tell them that. Now, again, not everybody can handle the same news the same way, right? I'm the kind of person who I don't like to twist in the wind. If my job's being cut next month, I want to know today so I can start building my well. There's other people who, if you told them that, they will perseverate and they will cycle down into for 30 days and nothing will happen. So you got to understand, treat people how they want to be treated. You can treat people differently and still treat people equitably. You can treat people differently and still treat them all fairly. Great leaders don't just cookie cutter everything they say to everyone, right? Absent facts, people make stuff up. So you got to declare your intent. Dahlia, I'd like to have a conversation with you. The business is in rough position right now. We're all doing our best to try to build, you know, a glide path for the next 6 months to get us out of here. But I have to tell you, I'm uncertain what it looks like. I'm fairly confident your role is secure for at least 9 more weeks. My intent is to give you a heads up. I'm not trying to soften the beach that your job elimination is imminent, But I have to tell you right now, I don't know what it looks like after 9 weeks. My intent is to be transparent with you. And I hope that my transparency won't turn into you checking out and spending all of your time looking for a job. My intent is to respect you as a colleague and as a person who's built this business. But my intent is also to build trust with you by being vulnerable and truthful around what the future looks like. I would like to continue to talk about what we're both doing to build your viability in the company. At the same time, in full disclosure, tell you I'm concerned about what October looks like for your role.
I realize that we're like super short on time, but I have to squeeze this in. No. I have to squeeze this in. So you've published a few books. I'm sure people, based on the extra amount of time that they have on their hands, they're probably going to explore that route. What made you choose that medium? And then also, what was your path? How were you able to get published?
Sure. So I'm an avid book reader. You can see behind me, I read about 200 books a year. My mother instilled that in me from birth. I came down every morning to the kitchen and she was reading the Orlando Sentinel. My mother was not a professional woman, homemaker, but she instilled in me the value of knowing the importance of reading. I've been a lifelong reader. And so I was 50 when I decided to write a book because I didn't think I had anything to say before that. And all of a sudden I said, no, I do have something to say. So I wrote the book. Obviously, I had a lot of connections being in the industry, right? So I had an advantage for that. Publishers want great books. So it may seem daunting to get into the publishing business. Some people self-publish. Some publish through Amazon. Some go to the big houses. A lot of these independent publishers are hungry for new authors. The average time a book hits a bestseller is someone's fourth to sixth book. I've interviewed Rachel Hollis, John Gray, Chicken Soup Guys, Jim Collins. Usually it's your third to fourth to fifth book that becomes a big one. Rachel Hollis, who's a friend of mine, it was her sixth book, Girl, Wash Your Face, that actually got her the fame. First five books, nothing. Not nothing, but next to nothing. So I would say don't let anybody else create your future. Don't let anybody else tell lies about you, steer you in their direction, tell you what you should do. Get clear on what it is you want to talk about and put it out there. Start on LinkedIn. Put some articles out. Write some things for Facebook. Small local paper. Start small. It's what I did. I wrote 75 articles on LinkedIn, and then I got a column for Inc. magazine. I wrote 75 more columns, and I landed a publishing deal, right? Is nobody's success is overnight. You only see the person on television or their book. You don't see the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of efforts they did to reinvent themselves and keep themselves back on track. Only see the success.
Sky, you said we were going to come back to this. To friend up, tell us what that means.
Yeah, hands down, next to my voracious reading, which has built my knowledge base, my vocabulary, a decent level of speaking extemporaneously, friending up has been the second most important tool that I've implemented in my brand and my career. Now, when some people hear it, they think it sounds fairly self-serving, but give me a latitude for a moment. Friending up, I don't know if I coined that phrase or somebody else did, is all around associating yourself with people who are more successful, more cultured, wiser, more educated, more diverse, wealthier than you are. I always try to friend up from the time I was 18 years old. When my college friends were out at frat parties, you know, boozing up, I was in the mayor's office looking at how she managed the weekly county commission schedule, right? Or I was at the school superintendent's rezoning commission. I'm not a total nerd. I am wearing cufflinks on a Tuesday. I get it. But I always friended up. My wife, I was married when I was 41. My wife is 12 years younger than I am. We went on a trip to Greece with a couple who was in their 60s. My wife's like, what am I getting into? What's going on here? Like, why are all your friends like 60 and 70? Well, I don't know. Why do they pull up in a Maserati? I don't know. Why do they own the largest private equity company in town? I don't know. I mean, but I didn't do it for me to be an opportunist. I did it to learn more from their mistakes, from what they chose and why they chose it, what they said no to, what they said yes to. I learned a tremendous amount from all these people who were older and wiser and more successful than me, because they all had major challenges they faced, right? decisions they made around honoring or not honoring their marital vows, what they did to their brand, to their children's health, right? Things they invested in, wisely or unwisely, money they loaned when it should have been a gift because it was never paid back. I learned so much. Now, this does not mean that I don't help people that can't help me. I dedicate 1 hour every day, 60 minutes every day to helping people. My inbox is crushed. How do I get a publisher? How do I get an editor? How do I start a podcast? How do I get a source in China to create this, right? I spend 1 hour every day accepting usually about 3 to 4 emails helping people I never will talk to ever again. At the same time, friending up has been the single most ROI'd investment I've made in myself. At the same time, let me tell you, all these people are now in their 70s and 80s. They're calling me, wanting me to help get them on Zoom. They're calling me help to figure out how to get their Stitcher podcast loaded, right? They're calling me because I can now help them as well. So for those who have seen it as me being an opportunistic, I don't think that's a even remotely accurate description of me. But friending up to people will be the biggest dividend you can pay to stretching your own skill, to building your network, to people taking you under their arms. And while you are friending up, help others. I don't think the opposite of friending up is friending down. I think it's reaching out and helping people who also could need a hand, because my success, to the degree Dahlia I've had any, is purely because, to revisit the original point, someone believed in me more than I believed in myself and lifted me up into an opportunity, shepherded me, coached me, took me aside and had a high courage conversation with me and said, Scott, you cannot do that ever again. And if you do, I'm out. It's those kind of conversations that were instrumental in moving me through my brand.
Scott, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us. If anybody does want to reach out to you, what's the best way to connect with you?
Well, my wife says it's not hard to find me, and that isn't a compliment from her. So you can connect to me on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter. You can Google On Leadership with Scott Miller. It's the name of our podcast, and subscribe to it. Some great guests. We interviewed John Gray, released today, the author of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. He was a monk for like 9 years. And then 9 years thinking about sex, went out and had a bunch of sex and then used all those interviews to write that book. It was the craziest interview ever. How do I publish this? I work for a public company. But these podcasts like yours, you know, are fascinating sometimes. So thank you for the platform. You've both been delightful. Stay safe and hope our paths cross again.
Thanks so much for tuning in. Be sure to subscribe to the Motivated Podcast and also stay tuned on LinkedIn and Instagram for some behind the scenes and extra updates.